as a result, you got it on?
Yeah.
As a result of this change to zone operations,
mm-hmm.
There was a certain level of dealer loss, dealers that quit
mm-hmm.
or
right.
went broke or whatever happened to them. And so the next job I had was the so-called special representative, which is a very fancy title that says you're in charge of finding new dealers. And I had a group of about five or six real hot shots working for me. And our job was to go around the country and discover and dig up dealer prospects, which was not easy because I'm speaking now of the early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And Hudson, the bloom was off the Hudson Rose, meaning
mm-hmm.
The Hornet and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And life was very difficult. And nevertheless, we were able to do, I guess, a reasonably acceptable job. I used to have to write a report directly to Barrett every week on
mm-hmm.
exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And he paid attention to it, too, to my surprise. If I ever didn't repeat something saying I'll report on this next week, well, he would remind me of it. But
mm-hmm.
anyway, sometime in the course of all that, they decided I ought to be assistant sales manager. And because I had organized that on a fairly effective basis, where we had representatives in each zone, and I had written all the book of rules on how to do it, and where you prospect, and how you find them, and how you close them, and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about 53, I guess, along in there. And then in 54, the telephone call came to Denver saying Mason wants to talk. And as you know, the merger was effective in May of 54.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the end of the Hudson period.
What had happened? You started out bravely with the Hornet, the step-down Hornet. That was quite an innovation at the time. And I seem to recall reading about Spring and talking to Bob Cotto that had been designed back in the late 30s, but had been put on the shelf.
I was told, I don't know that
yeah.
for a fact, but I was
yeah.
told that it was there and had been thought through, and they were waiting, I suppose, for a period when there was enough financial muscle to be able to do, because it was a completely new tooling job. It was a revolutionary approach to building an automobile.
Right.
And it was not one that you could just take a basic platform and modify it, and which is what most everybody does even today.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I'm sure that was the case. It wasn't hatched during the war.
No, no. And I think Barrett was probably, according to what I've read, was probably against it for a while. Even after the war, apparently, according to Langworth, he complained it was too low in 41, and he wasn't interested. It was selling very well with the facelifts, but then that market dried up, and Spring hauled out the step down and said, we got to do it. And according to Langworth's anecdote, Barrett drove it home, still muttering about the styling, but literally changed his mind overnight. He finally
oh, really?
What an excellent road machine it was. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. That's
yeah.
an aspect that I never heard.
Yeah. But there you are then. But while the Hornet, great as it was, and except as it was for a while, eventually the began to sort of taper off.
Well, my interpretation
yeah,
is this. First of all, the design of that vehicle did not lend itself to modification.
I see.
Because the structure was right there. It was all built right into it.
Monobuilt.
And that included the structure inside the, or over the roof, or inside the quarter panels,
mm-hmm.
the whole thing. And any radical change in terms of making it wider or narrower or longer or shorter or whatever was expensive and complex.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole industry then went on that splurge, you might say, of fins and perfectly god-awful gaudy automobiles.
Right.
And when we made an effort to do that, we put an artificial air intake on the front of the hood, which looked like hell.
Mm-hmm.
We put artificial extensions on the tops of the rear fenders, which looked equally bad. We did a whole lot of junk like that. We put artificial overlays on the fenders to look like a contour change, which it wasn't. And everything that you did to it just made it look worse. but was an effort to make it more in keeping with the then trend to these elongated, heavily chromed automobiles that everybody else was, people were buying.
Mm-hmm.
And then the money that was necessary. Then the question was, shouldn't we have a competitor in the lower end of the field?
Right.
And that led to the jet.
Mm-hmm.
And my feeling is that the money spent on tooling the jet, if they had taken that same money and extensively retooled the 48, the Hornet, let's say, the 48 Hudson,
mm-hmm, right,
would have been much better directed, because the jet turned out to be a homely automobile.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going around selling the idea to our distributors that who were then left, or our major dealers, and mostly they were then, we had a little presentation package with a rendering of the jet.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody had taken, you know, the way they can do with a camera, they'd taken the thing and stretched it out. They elongated it, because the jet was a square little, looked like a German automobile. And in the picture, it was really pretty damn good looking. And you'd lead up to this, and then you'd flip the page and show, you had a little presentation easel, and you'd show them this glamorous picture. Well, it was a terrible mistake, in my opinion. I hadn't even seen the car at this point. None of us had.
Uh-huh.
And when I saw it, and I knew what I'd been selling, I don't know, because it didn't look, it just didn't look like the car that we had been telling these guys, this is coming. And, you know, there's nothing worse than overselling something and having it become a terrible disappointment. And the dealers looked at it and they, you know, this is the thing that I and others like me had been out there convincing them was the savior.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, hindsight is certainly a lot easier. but it wouldn't have taken a lot of foresight to look at that automobile and tell you it's a mistake, in my opinion.
The
but that happens to be my yeah.
Is
it wound up by being compromised in order to accommodate the interior dimensions, and it just wound up all just out of proportion.
And after the initial surge of enthusiasm, you didn't sell.
No, I don't even remember the initial surge of enthusiasm, but I'm glad to know there was one.
Perhaps it was very small.
No, and it meant that it, I'm certain, was instrumental in putting the company in a cash shortage position, or and putting them maybe in a position of having a lot of money invested in tooling. That although Murray Body put up a lot of the dough to build the tools for that.
Apparently $5 million, what, yeah.
Is that all it was?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
Because you can't tool a fender for that.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever it was, it, in those days it was a big number, and I never did find out what finally happened to those tools.
Mm-hmm.
I heard a story one time that they were sent to Japan, which is a most unlikely prospect.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they never got worn out, I can tell you that.
Well, who was responsible for the jet? Who forced that on the company, do you remember?
No, I don't. I think Mr. Barrett probably got the blame for it, which is not unusual, but it was...
There's been a change here in the engineering area pretty much about this time. Tom Gray had taken over for Frame, I think.
Tom Gray, he
at least chief engineer. Right?
He was the chief engineer, yeah. And not Peter, but he was never the chief stylist.
Yeah.
And I've forgotten when Spring left.
Spring apparently continued as chief body engineer.
Oh, did he?
In the late 40s, yeah. Does that ring a bell?
No.
Seems odd, yeah.
No, it doesn't.
Apparently something went wrong, and but someone apparently forced the jet onto a somewhat reluctant company. You say it might have been Barrett, yeah. Could well have been. Well, so the storm clouds are gathering, the jet is practically a disaster, and you're losing money, and there's a... Barrett sees a way out.
Oh, you know, something had to happen.
Yeah, right.
As I say, at that time, there was a talk about Packard, Studebaker, Nash, and Hudson all getting together.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was about 1953.
Yeah, in the early 50s.
Yeah, right.
And that like most of those things, it's almost impossible to rationalize all the different points of view when you have as many diverse characters as we had running the company, those companies. And as you know, ultimately, Studebaker and Packard did get together, and of course, then in May of 54, the Nash and Hudson took place.
Apparently, Barrett and Mason had had discussions some years before.
Yeah.
About common tooling and a common...
Yes. And as I say, I think at that time also there was a discussion that Packard would supply the engines. There was going to be sort of a let's get together and each do something for each other.
Yeah, that might have worked.
Well, and it sounds good in theory, but there are just too many competitive aspects to make a four-way thing like that really work, unless they're all under one general ownership or one, you know, in some holding company or something like that. You might do it like General Motors, but I can't imagine it would happen just as four independents all agreeing to supply one another.
Well, if you had Packard and Studebaker forming a triumvirate, that would have been a fascinating experiment.
Yeah, it would have been.
Or, I mean, the whole spectrum of the market.
And it's, of course, I wasn't privy to any of those discussions, but I know that a lot of people recognized the handwriting on the wall and were trying to do something about it, and Mason was the really the prime mover. He really got things going, and he finally decided that he could do something with us best, which delighted me.
Mason was really the spark plug of the deal, as you would say.
And I think he had the most advanced approach to automotive design. That Nash Air Flight was a very fine automobile. They had some little weirdy things about it, but and he had somebody smart enough to go to Italy and get Farina to do the body styling, and it was
George Walker too at one point.
George was in at some point, I know.
Yeah, you were the first to employ a fairly well known at that time European Italian designer. That was great.
It was, and he did a little sports car, the Farina.
Okay. Right.
Well, I'll tell you a little anecdote about that. When the word came out we were going to get together with Nash, I thought, well, I better go around and look at these automobiles. So I went to the Nash dealership in Grosse Pointe. And if you recall, at that time, the front fender opening, where the front wheel is, was enclosed on the Nashes. There was no cutout the way you normally would see in an automobile. And I thought it looked kind of strange, and I couldn't imagine what purpose other than to be distinctive. So I asked the salesman, I said, now why do you have these wheels enclosed like that? That looks awfully straight. He says, oh, he said, that's very, very important. I said, well, why is it important? He said, it inhibits the turbulence. I said, it does what? He said, it inhibits the turbulence. I said, would you please tell me, where did you get that phrase? He said, it says right there in the sales book, it inhibits the turbulence, is what he was trying to say. And if anybody ever worried about turbulence around the front wheel, it's the first time I ever heard of it. But they were being asked that question by a lot of people. Well, the next year they opened it up, or a year or so later. But Nash did have some. They had unitized construction. They had a very high level of economy with the then Nash 400 or whatever they called it, 600 maybe, which subsequently maybe devolved into the Rambler, and. And they had George Mason, who was an absolute gem of a man.
Tell us a bit about him. You were, of course, quite mature by this time, and you probably got a chance to meet him and work
with him. Well, I knew him quite well, mostly because we were both very active in something called Ducks Unlimited, which was a conservation organization. And George was he wasn't the national head, but he was the head for all this part of the world. And I worked on it with him, and he had a beautiful place down by Amherstburg, a shooting place, duck shooting, and he loved it, and he used to entertain a lot of people down there, and we got invited a couple of times, and I discovered that the reason I was invited was that if he was short one of his guides, he'd get me down there, and he'd say, Roy, now you take the boat and the decoys and the dog and our guest here and take them out to so-and-so, and I'd go out and punt the boat and set the decoys and handle the dog and retrieve the ducks and maybe even shoot them for the guest if he was having trouble. But I recognized my role, but I loved it. It couldn't have been better, and George got a kick out of it, too. And
Amherstburg is sort of the mecca of all duck hunters in this area.
Well, that's the downriver stuff. Then there's a lot of good stuff up on the other side of Lake St. Clair, too, where I had a marsh for 25 years.
Did you?
Anyway, that's how George and I got to know one another.
And he
had a great interest. And then also he was a fine fly fisherman. I mean,
was
he? Really dedicated trout fisherman. In fact, the first board meeting that we had of the new American Motors was in June. And as I said, Barrett and I were the two Hudson survivors. Was up at George's camp on the Osable, at the Grayling. And it was there are all kinds of stories attached to that, but it was because I was riding my element, and I never had a better time.
Can you tell us one good one? The relationship with George's character and your relationship with him.
Yeah, well, George was a tremendous host, and he just wanted everybody to have a good time. And up there, what you did, he had all these boats. They're long, called Saba River boats, which are quite narrow but quite long, and they're punted by an experienced guide, and you go down the river and fish, and. Barrett had never done anything like this, but of course he was included. And apparently they went down the river, and Barrett got out on the bank, or a little dock, and he came to get back in the boat. He put one foot in the boat, kept the other on the dock, and it's, you know, typical story. The boat moved away in the current, and down he went. And they brought him in, and I was late getting in. I was fishing. And I came in, and everybody was in the nice big living room, and I over in a wing chair over in the corner, wrapped in blankets, was Barrett. And I said, "My God, what happened to Mr. Barrett?" Because, you know, he was a very formal, very, probably had a three-piece suit on when he was fishing, I don't know. But anyway, and a complete gentleman, really a wonderful gentleman. And I said to I said to one of the guys, I said, "What happened to Barrett?" And he said, "He fell in." And I said,
and
"Jesus, is he all right?" Because he's sitting there. And I went over and I said, "Mr. Barrett, how are you?" And he said, "All right, I'm just fine." I don't think that he bundled him up in blankets, but they'd fill him up with bourbon whiskey, I think. And it was the absolute antithesis of what I had known in Barrett for 25 years or whatever it was. But it was pretty funny. But you know, that didn't last long. He got right back in the spirit of everything, but it was interesting to see those different characters, because most of the people on the Nash board were people that George fished and shot with. They were guys, or at least if they were close in the company, who were the various vice presidential levels, or they were from outside the company in the banking world or whatever. Percy Abbott of Chase and people like that.
Yeah,
they were all great sportsmen. The guy, the fellow who was the head of the what you might call the educator on the board, was a guy named George Brown, who was from the University of Michigan. He was the head of the dean of the business school, I think. Percy Abbott, who was the chairman of the Chase Bank. Let me see how many more I can think of. A fellow named Harlan Pierpont, who was a Eastern capitalist, let's say. Then there were, and those are the ones that immediately come to mind. Then, of course, George Romney was on the board.
Right.
And
George
was executive vice president at that
to,
time.
To Mason, yeah,
yeah,
Mason Project.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then,
were the Matthys in at this point?
No, they were never in.
Oh, wasn't Fred Matthys?
Fred's a friend of George's. They were both good Mormons together, but that's.
But I
used to come out to the office occasionally. I'd see him there, but no.
Okay.
Well, they may have owned some, but they never appeared.
Yeah.
And then, what the Dickens was that guy's name? He came from. They had three Ford fellows there that had been ex-Fords. And then they were all just characters, wonderful guys.
Mm-hmm.
One of whom had run purchasing, and one ran the Kelvinator division. Charlie. Well, anyhow, they were all guys that were very much comfortable with Mason and the fishing and the shooting and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And great storytellers and great gin rummy players and all the rest of that stuff. And damn good men, So it was I just loved it. I just fit right in there. That was fine with me.
Yeah.
And
you've been an outdoorsman since your early youth.
Yeah, it had been something I'd always been interested in, and I knew how to do.
I think Los Alamos gave you some.
That had a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
It got you. I guess it got you started on what you know, being comfortable in being in the outdoors. And well, I'll tell you a little one on Romney, which this
Please.
Doesn't appear in. Publicly for a while. It's pretty funny, but it's a perfectly typical one of George. He and I were assigned to fish together the first day. And I just met George. I didn't really know him. I'd seen him around and been introduced and so on. And he was a tremendously attractive, dynamic guy, still is.
Sure.
And we got in the boat, and he's the executive vice president, and I'm a little assistant sales manager.
Mm-hmm.
So I say, George, why don't you fish first? So he gets up, and George is this kind of fisherman, bang, bang. You know, everything is very intense.
Mm-hmm.
And he finally, not much happened. He finally sat down, and he said, you fish now. So I got up, and God, it was beautiful. The sun was shining, and the birds were singing, and it was just, we were on the south branch of the Osava, which
mm-hmm.
is a stretch that Mason subsequently left in trust to be maintained, to Trout Unlimited. Anyway, I've done a lot of trout fishing, and I got a little fish and I had a lot of fun with it and brought it in. And I said, George, it's your turn now. He said, no, he said, you keep on. So I said, well, okay, so I started fishing again. And I finally got another fish. I said, George, come on, what are you doing? And I looked at him, he's sitting in the center of the boat. He said, I'm writing a speech.
Really?
So help me. And I thought, boy, that's the ultimate in dedication. I couldn't even think about a speech where I was at the moment.
Besides, with the mystique that had grown up around trout fishing, that occupied your whole being.
Absolutely. Once I did that, I couldn't think about anything else. Which is, of course, one of the great things about it, is if you'd be maybe loaded with cares of the world and you get out on a trout stream or a bonefish flat or whatever, and you can't keep them. Well, anyway, it was a great tribute to George because, you know, he's just, that's the kind of a guy he was and is that when he's dedicated to something, boy, that's it, because he really made things happen.
And he was really the spark plug behind the merger.
Mason was. I'm talking about Romney for the moment.
Yeah,
Mason was the mover on the merger. But then, as you know, Mason died in October of '84.
Right,
yeah, it was only 6 months later.
Yeah.
And George took over.
Now, he had been a protege of Mason.
He was executive vice president. He was the number two guy in the company.
He'd come from government service, I think.
He was a secretary to one of the senators from Utah. What was that guy's famous?
Hatch.
A long time ago. The name you'd remember, and I've forgotten that.
Right, yeah.
And he was in Washington, and then he came to the Automobile Manufacturers Association.
Right.
He was
the head
of that.
Name during World War II.
He was the head of that.
Yeah.
And then George Mason lured him away from there.
Yeah.
And he's in October of '54, Romney took over.
Well, by this time the merger had became a reality. And, how did they decide on American Motors? Who was the idea man on that?
Oh, that was sort of a name that was always just sort of there. I remember discussing it in a board meeting, but I don't even remember any alternatives being suggested. And I think George liked it, and it gave you a chance to be sort of, which I'm sure Mr. Iacocca is going to take advantage of, to tie it in a little more to the American. I always wanted to do a little more of the patriotic approach. I mean, incorporate a little red, white, and blue here and there, and so
which
on.
But you did.
Well, we did. We put it in our racing jackets and things like that.
Your logo.
And the logo. That's right.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. Well, anyhow, that was the beginning of what you might call the Rambler era.
There was a period for a couple of years in which it was sort of awkward. The merger was kind of awkward. You were in Kenosha and you were here. And
well, that didn't last very long.
Mm-hmm.
It started out it was about a year. But because we had a Hudson Rambler and a Nash Rambler, which was just a matter of what nameplate you put on the front of it. And the Hudson was really the old Hudson people called it a hash, which is a Hudson emblem and a few little things on a Nash body, a different grill and a few little changes like that.
Yeah.
But the biggest problem we had, and I was involved in this, was keeping it from becoming an us and them kind of thing,
right.
We and they.
And
I was kind of people who was, you know, who was obviously a Hudson man born and bred,
sure.
Who was kind of expected to sort of set a pace for discourage and wherever you saw it, eliminate that
mm-hmm.
kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it was a trial for maybe 6-8 months, but then bit by bit it became perfectly obvious what the route was, and then the Rambler became sort of the symbol of the company.
Was Romney pretty much in the vanguard of the development of the Rambler, do you think?
He was very enthusiastic about it, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that's where he fell apart with Clay Doss, who was the sales manager for Nash, who had come from Ford and who was, quote, a big car man.
Yes.
And Clay was a delightful man. He was what I call a typical old-time automobile sales manager.
His father had been sales manager for Ford.
Well, he was, this guy.
And he wasn't after him, yeah.
Well, was he really? I mean, I didn't know there were two Clay Dosses.
But no, well, no, but there was another Doss. I think it was his father, but back in the 20s, who'd been a
Oh, really?
Well,
I never realized that.
If they ever there.
Yeah, well, they may. Anyway, that's what, when he was tagged, right or wrong, as a big car enthusiast, mm-hmm. and Romney was convinced, as turned out correctly, that the Rambler was the way to go, and that's when Abernathy came on the scene.
Now, what happened to Barrett? I think he
resigned from the board.
He was unhappy with the dropping of the Hudson name, was he?
Yeah, I don't think he... Yes, I mean, I think he felt that Hudson was going to continue more as an entity than it did,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know why he felt that way, because it seemed to me... we were never made any commitments that I know of. Maybe
right.
he was, and that meant nothing to me. And I think he felt that he was going to be a lone voice on the board, that, you know, here I was on the payroll,
right.
and so I was obviously going to be part of the Nash, if you want to call it, or the Nash influence group.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're looking realistically down the road, obviously.
And that he just didn't see that it was going to be any... You know, just being a director, there was no executive committee, or
yeah.
there was no anything really? that he had. He had absolutely no role at all.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't even know if he was on any of the board committees.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even think we had any board committees in those days. George ran everything. Mason ran everything.
Yeah,
it was beautiful. But you know, it was very effective.
Yeah.
And so then Barrett left, and I'm not sure when, but I would think in the
December
fall.
'56.
Yeah, I was going to say the fall or winter of that same year.
And then,
he said stayed till 56, did you say?
December 56.
Really? Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm wrong. I thought he left in sometime in the winter of 55. Anyway.
Well, let's check your...
Well,
it's
not important, yeah, but it... But
that was the reason he left. He largely was still a Hudson partisan, and he hated to see it. He hated to see his influence being diminished, too.
Well, that I think, was the most important thing,
yeah.
as we all would understand.
Well... You and George must have gotten along well, because he turned to you for a very important situation here. How did it come about?
Well,
you and George Romney.
Yeah, well, what happened really was that they suddenly waked up to the fact that they had a vice president of finance who was 63 and a treasurer who was 64 or something like that,
mm-hmm.
and really nobody behind them. And they called me in one day and said, what do you know about finance? And I said, well, I know the difference between a stock and a bond, and I can balance my checkbook, and I know where the bank is. What's the question about?
You had a year on Wall Street, too.
And, well, actually, it was Griswold Street. and they said, well, you're the new assistant treasurer. And I said, well, that's an interesting... Maybe I better go find out what a treasurer does. And fortunately, our treasurer was a wonderful man, and he was a fellow named Godfrey Strellinger.
Strellinger. There was a Strellinger in the early Ford history, too.
Yeah.
One of the original stockholders.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, they had a big wholesale hardware company here for years. You remember? Strellinger. And I don't know who that was. But anyway, he was extremely helpful. I mean, first of all, he realized that he was headed out pretty soon, and he better cover his track, and so I got a lot of responsibility quite quickly, even more so than I expected, because about 3 or 4 months after I came on as the assistant treasurer, and I'm not even sure just when that was, but it was probably the spring of 56 or somewhere along in there, his wife became very ill, and he took early retirement. So
you were assistant treasurer from 54 to 55.
Well, then it was 55, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And
I was supposed to stay until 56, and then he, as I said, his wife became ill, and he took early retirement or left, and so I became treasurer rather quickly.
And vice president of finance.
No, that came subsequently.
Oh, in 55.
Yeah, I think 55 I became treasurer.
Right.
And then in 56 or 57, I became the other fellow who had been Strellinger's boss, a fellow named Howard Lewis, who had, they had an interesting arrangement, which was mostly you know, you'd adjust your responsibilities to the individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Howard Lewis was a great internationalist. So he ran all the international business, meaning mostly Kelvinator overseas, and also all the finance. He was both. He was chief financial officer and chief international officer. And so I inherited that role, which was really inappropriate in that you just couldn't, as things got more difficult, as finance became more complex, as you know, you got into big credit agreements and things like that, it was just impossible to be in Tehran and when you got a financial problem. So, but I ran that joint job for a couple of years, I think it was.